Royal Sparks stylish spinsters. Miss Jean Brodie passed her prime. Muriel Spark was not a spinster. She was a woman disappointed by the standard marriage plot. At 19, she traveled from Edinburgh to Africa to marry a man she barely knew. Stanley Oswald Spark was, as it turned out, mentally unstable. The young Muriel found herself supporting him and their infant son, moving around the continent for 5 years before divorcing and returning to Scotland. Over the next, that is, the remaining 6 decades of her life, Spark engaged in several serious love affairs. She may have hoped to remarry, but her Christian conversion in the 50s ended both those hopes and the affairs. More than that, her single-minded literary ambitions drew her towards singleness. Very pretty, immensely charming, frequently gregarious, Spark eventually learned that men attracted by her did not necessarily consider her their equal. As her character Fleur Talbot says of her literary lover, "He often liked what I wrote, but disliked my thoughts of being a published writer." And in fact, Carolyn of the Comforters, 1957, Spark's very first novel, finds her lover Lawrence and men in general secondary, if not dispensable. Where else, John Updike uneasily asked, in the fiction of the 50s, do we find a heroine whose heterosexuality is so calmly brought forward and assigned a secondary priority? Well, perhaps in Spark's other novels. Certainly in her life, which she ended with a female companion rather than traditional love or marriage. Perhaps her personal history gave Spark an extra sympathy for the spinsters who populate her fiction, and especially for her famous Miss Jean Brodie. The stereotypical spinster is, as Laura Doan has written, defined by what she lacks, a man, a marriage. The classic Victorian spinster was viewed as a sad but inevitable part of British society. She might compensate for her state by good works, like Florence Nightingale, or even creative acts like Jane Austen and Christina Rossetti. But with the coming of modernism and popular psychosexual treatises by Havelock Ellis and Sigmund Freud, people began to believe that spinsters must be sexually frustrated and warped. This growing belief coincided with a societal increase in spinsters, in Britain, that is. Surplus women, whose singleness was ensured by so many young men's deaths in the Great War. I beg your pardon, Lucy, I just realized I referred to, included Scotland and Britain in saying this. The Great War applies here. We're going to talk about Jean Brodie, who is both one of these surplus women. She makes her little girls weep by talking about her Hugh, who fell like an autumn leaf just before the armistice. And she's a spinster also. She endeavors to escape the stereotypes. Working. Maggie Smith in the film version from 1969. Not a perfect Jean Brodie, but perfect in her imperiousness, certainly. Seen as an object, Jean Brodie, a spinster who normally would be marginalized, endeavors to harness the power of the objectifying gaze by styling herself as an object, by self-aestheticizing. She fascinates the young girls she teaches through her own overtly ridiculous, vivid style. "I wore my silk dress with the large red poppies, which is just right for my coloring," she tells her girls. "Mussolini is one of the greatest men in the world." This inappropriate non sequitur shows the teacher's delusive charm and the book's double perspectives of fascination and condemnation. Why does the dress even matter? Well, red is the color of passion, of sexuality, of look-at-me stances. Poppies, well, poppies are mentioned elsewhere in the novel, combining the memory of Flanders Field and Armistice Day with narcotic forgetfulness. And just right for my coloring will appear again in Spark's later novel, The Driver's Seat. Furthermore, if modern dress style promises, as Joanne Finkelstein has written, to annul the fragmented conditions of modernity with the imposition of a coherent subjectivity, then Jean Brodie, in choosing her red dress and magisterially announcing its effects, endeavors to impose her subjective self-vision upon her students, thus to control her body as perceived object. Jean Brodie was inspired by the young Muriel's charismatic teacher, Christina Kay. Miss Kay's red dress with poppies, her passions for Mussolini and for the arts, her amusing non sequiturs, all led to this fiction of a spinster teacher, who acts out her passions, enthralling her students and offending the authorities. In describing Miss K, Spark quoted John Steinbeck, "I have come to believe that a great teacher is a great artist." And in inventing Miss Brodie, descendant of a famously creative Edinburgh criminal, Spark created a spinster who deviously styles her own life. Deacon Brodie was, according to the story, hung upon a gallows he himself had constructed. Jean Brodie's self-styling project includes her effort to fully affirm her own singleness. "If I were to receive a proposal of marriage tomorrow from the Lord Lion King of Arms, I would decline it," she tells her girls. "I am dedicated to you in my prime." Despite her overt sensuality, she explicitly views her single state as integral to her prime. Her little girls sense a paradox here. As they have observed, married people, such as their parents, don't have primes, they have sexual intercourse. But Miss Brodie does want sexual intercourse. She wants it all. She is, the narrator explains, one of Edinburgh's legions of single women who crowded their war-bereaved spinsterhood with voyages of discovery. So in affirming the negation, which is her spinsterhood, she is not unusual. But she is unusual in choosing to teach and dedicating her prime to her students. And there too lies her downfall, not in her affair with the singing master or her secret love for the art teacher, but her eventual efforts to use her girls as sexual and political surrogates impel her pupil Sandy to betray her. And how is betrayal linked to Jean Brodie's efforts to present herself as an aesthetic object? Miss Brodie may be artistic, but she does not fully comprehend or acknowledge her double nature. We know that because women traditionally have been objectified in the feminist truism, they are accustomed to objectifying themselves. As John Berger puts it in Ways of Seeing, men look at women, women watch themselves being looked at. Thus, she turns herself into an object. A similar willing self-objectification is necessary for following fashion, as Karen Hansen has noted. A personal interest in dress and open responsiveness to the changing whims of fashion depend upon a recognition that one is seen, that one is, among other things, an object of others' sight, others' cognition. So both their customary interest in fashion and their status as the second sex have given women an advantage in self-objectification. Charles Baudelaire has described the self-objectification inherent in comedy as a dédoublement, a self-splitting, which he also declared necessary for the artist. He wrote that a man who trips would be the last to laugh at his own fall unless he happened to be one who had acquired by habit a power of rapid self-division and thus of assisting as a disinterested spectator at the phenomena of his own ego. And Baudelaire was rather interested in the sort of comic pratfall music hall genre of his time. But the complex self-splitting he describes is very modernist, of course. Théophile Gautier said of Baudelaire himself, every sensation he experiences has to be analyzed by him. Involuntarily, he separates his two selves, il se dédouble, and when he lacks any other subject, takes to spying upon himself. Well, to divide oneself is both modern and artistic. What about spying? And what about spying upon oneself? Spark's cool-eyed protagonists frequently are accused of spying. Even to live life as a detached observer is to evoke suspicions of betrayal, a common theme in Spark's own life, by the way. The links between self-splitting and betrayal appear in many of her novels, too. However, while covert operations and self-doubling typify modern literature, an extreme self-objectification seems to me especially feminine. Again, women watch themselves being watched. Yet, if Spark has one message, throughout her fiction, it is about the dual rewards and dangers of aestheticizing experience, of taking that Yeatsian journey to Byzantium through which one turns oneself into artifice. Jean Brodie seems to aestheticize herself without the concomitant spying upon herself, the dédoublement. The narrative never tells us her thoughts, always showing her through the speculations of her young students or a bemused larger world, observing Miss Brodie's melodramatic personal style. Head up, like Sybil Thorndike, her nose arched and proud. But although the spinster teacher is so ostensibly the risible object rather than the narrating subject of her story, the novel bears a complex sympathy for her tragic overreaching, which offers an allegory of the British Empire. In the 30s, Jean Brodie naively celebrates the rise of fascism on the continent. Appropriately then, her downfall occurs in 1939, and she dies of cancer in 1946. If the First War, World War I, serves as locus of the romantic for Sparks' teacher, the second delineates the destruction of Britain's glory and Miss Brodie's. Early on, she sits nobly like Britannia with her legs apart in Mr. Lloyd's art class. But she will hunch, shriveled and betrayed, past her prime after the war's end. Incidentally, there's no such scene in the movie. I would love to see Maggie Smith hunching, shriveled, and betrayed, but they just don't go that far. Too much of a downer. Well, what happens to Miss Brodie? She loves aesthetic ideals. She quotes Walter Pater on the Mona Lisa and romantic art. One of her favorites is Tennyson's Lady of Shalott, recited with head thrown back and eyes closed. So I'll show you the sort of art she loves, Pre-Raphaelite. She left the web, she left the loom, she made three paces through the room, she saw the water lily bloom, she saw the helmet and the plume, she looked down to Camelot. Tennyson's legendary figure makes the error of leaving her sheltered castle, her domicile, and her esoteric weaving, proper feminine sphere and activity. She leaves her loom, she eyes the handsome Lancelot, she desires the world of love and action, Camelot. The lady is an isolated priestess of art who tries to pursue love in the real world, and so she dies. Likewise with Jean Brodie. But like Tennyson's lady, she too will die when she endeavors to impose her fantasies on actual history. Their teacher's insouciant self-aestheticizing nonetheless fascinates her girls. "I went with my friends for an audience with the Pope," she says. "I wore a long black gown with a lace mantilla and looked magnificent." This frankly subjective rhetoric, the mixing of the momentous and the trivial, you know, the Pope and the dress, is part of her art. As Sandy perceives, the teacher self-consciously employs her personal style to make patterns of facts. Sandy herself leads a double life of her own in order never to be bored. And it is this self-doubling talent that leads Miss Brodie rightly to predict that Sandy will make a great spy. Sandy possesses a deeper talent for dedoublement than her teacher. She can move easily between her fantasies and her life without confusing the two. From listening to the embroidering of Hugh's story with double ears, to studying Teddy Lloyd's paintings in which Rose and all the girls look like Jean Brodie, she comes to see that Miss Brodie cannot separate herself from her own fictions. The teacher presents but cannot fully view herself as an object, having a defective sense of self-criticism. In endeavoring to induce her girls to act out her desires, as lovers or as fighters, she becomes dangerous. Her final manipulations prompt Sandy, acting as Graham Greene suggested the modern novelist should act, as a counter-spy, to betray her to the school authorities. What is Sparks' own attitude towards her creation? Sparks' imagery, like Miss Brodie herself, is both enchanted and ironically twisted. So those bright poppies on the teacher's dress, the color of passion, also evoke drugs and death. As we know, the poppies bloom on Flanders Field, where Jean's youthful lover Hugh fell. In another ironically precious image, Jean Brodie in her prime begins to wear newer clothes and a glowing amber necklace with magnetic properties that she demonstrates to her girls. Her own attraction for the two male teachers at the school is a patent analogy, but we know what amber truly is, and that Miss Brodie is caught, surely as any insect, in a grotesquely frozen beauty. In self-staging herself as prime object of desire, she inadvertently wears the signs of her desire's end. Yet finally, it's her grand affinities with Mussolini and with Caesar, as Miss Brodie flattens those who scorn her beneath the chariot wheels of her superiority, that brings Sandy to betray her. And yet also, put Sandy behind iron bars at the novel's end, a frustrated and, one infers, guilt-ridden nun, the ultimate version of spinsterhood. In the end, a spinster style crowns the futility of Miss Brodie's much vaunted prime. She sits shriveled and betrayed in her long-preserved dark musquash coat, the stylish kind of fur coat, a muskrat for all the Americans here, which women in Britain and Scotland like to wear in the 30s. But she sits there shriveled, hunched over, dying of cancer, as she admits, "I am past my prime, and Hitler was rather naughty." Now the non sequitur is pathetic, not comic, and less of a non sequitur to our understanding. The Girls of Slender Means, Sparks' novel of 1963, offers a cooler, though no less problematic, look at self-aestheticization. The May of Tech Club houses a variety of single women, some classic spinsters, others engaged in romance. All the girls in the story accept the male gaze as a culmination of modernity. Yet, contrary to their era's assumptions, it's not clear that they style themselves for men, though they're very interested in clothing. For Spark personally, dress served as an aesthetic ideal. In her memoir, she describes the fascinating details of her grandmother's Victorian attire, detailing chemises, stays, drawers, petticoats, and stockings, before arriving at outerwear and a crowning memory of a blue silk brocade dress called Bluebell. Here we have an Edwardian blue silk dress. Not the original Bluebell, I fear, but similar. Earlier in life, Muriel's grandmother had worn Bluebell to a fancy dress party and won a prize. Over 60 years later, Spark wrote, "I have never seen anything quite so beautiful, nor touched anything so sensuous before or since." Think about that. What fascinated young Muriel was the sensuous feel, by the way, not any concern about how others would view the dress's wearer. As if to drive the point home, early in her writing career, she named her beautiful long-haired cat Bluebell. Here's Bluebell. That is the real Bluebell. My son assured me I could find a picture of Muriel Spark's cat Bluebell on the internet, and indeed, there it was. Wonderful invention, the internet. Again, it's a surprising conversion from the seeming sociality of dress to an introverted domestic pleasure, a cat, seeing a cat, stroking a cat, taking care of a cat. Likewise, the lasting power of a beautiful dress recurs in The Girls of Slender Means as visually affecting to viewers, yes, but personally sensuously rewarding for the wearer. The fact that the Spark's climax in this novel hinges on choosing a beautiful couture gown over a human life should make us stop and ask, what is such a dress worth? As Karen Hansen shows, fashion's links to utility directly confound our longings for unchanging categories. If, as Kant says, this is Karen Hansen speaking, the satisfaction determined by the beautiful is unrelated to inclination, then one who would judge some fashionable dress beautiful will clearly have to cope with some difficult problems of desire. Difficult problems of desire. Ultimately, Spark used spinsters and dress to approach that notorious Freudian question, what do women want? For the spinster, defined by what she lacks, raises that question in its starkest form. As that famous spinster, novelist Barbara Pym, joked, men fear the spinster lest all passion not be spent. And to use one more Brodie instance, it is the absences that alarm. Miss Brodie's nightdress of crepe de chine damns her in the eyes of her fellow teachers, not by its presence under her lover's pillow, but through its subsequent absence. She's that brazen, they say. The clothing details comically jostle against the anxious suspicions about spinsterish desire. The Girls of Slender Means begins as a fairy tale. Long ago in 1945, all the nice people in England were poor, allowing for exceptions. And the climax turns like Cinderella on a magically transformative dress. But Spark quickly punctures any fairy tale expectations, observing that the bombed buildings look like the ruins of ancient castles, only until one sees the lavatory chains dangling over ruined walls. Likewise, the May of Tech Club, where the girls of slender means dwell, will be leveled by a long-buried bomb. It is not the golden age microcosm that the writer Nicholas imagines. And yet, its petty glamours and greeds propel him to a Catholic martyrdom. The catalyzing action of savagery so extreme occurs when Nicholas sees his lover, beautiful Celina, return as a fire threatens, slipping through a bathroom window, which only very slender girls can manage, as usual. Spark's title is a pun. Celina risks her life not to help the other girls, but in order to rescue and steal a beautiful Schiaparelli dress. Meanwhile, Joanna, the saintly rector's daughter, who is a traditional spinster, perishes along with her recitations of classic idealistic poetry from the Bible, the Book of Common Prayer, Shakespeare, and Gerard Manley Hopkins. Her neo-romantic poetic tastes echo those, by the way, of the young Spark. They may be limited, but they're broader than the vapid two-sentence mantra emphasizing elegant dress and immaculate grooming that glamorous Celina daily repeats. As usual, Spark suggests a wittily allegorical interpretation, here centered upon the opposing recitations and the amazing Schiaparelli dress with its pre-war avant-garde exoticism. It was made of taffeta, with small side panniers stuck out with cleverly curved pads over the hips. It was colored dark blue, green, orange, and white in a floral pattern as from the Pacific Islands. And I am so sorry I have not been able to find any such Schiaparelli gown anywhere. This is a typical beautiful dramatic style by the designer, the Italian designer, Elsa Schiaparelli, by the way, from the 1930s. Here's a few other sites from the recent exhibit at the Met a couple years ago. Perhaps the 1938 dress has some of those exotic island colors, standard Schiaparelli pink, standard use of feathers and fur. She loved fur. She loved incorporating surrealism into her fashions as much as possible. And obviously there's a connection with primitivism, savagery, and so forth that Spark wants to capture here. The girls of slender means borrow the dress in turn for special dates, and it transforms each one. They say it looks different on each one. It's the perfect image, too, for the complete disconnect between their attractions and traditional ethics. Few people alive at the time, comments the narrator, were more delightful, more ingenious, more movingly lovely, and, as it might happen, more savage than the girls of slender means. Just as Joanna's death reminds us that the era of elaborate romantic poetry is over, so the retro-savage dress represents the coffin lid upon the modernist dream of infinite self-making. The Schiaparelli's disappearance, we should just say theft, perhaps, is synchronized with the war's end. But already we know it was a masquerade costume, borrowed by each girl in turn in order to stage herself as stylish and desirable. Except for scheming literary Jane, whom the dress does not fit. Fat, but intellectually glamorous, to her housemates. In the end, the unstylish spinster Jane has sweated her way to her ideal observatory job of gossip columnist, but not to a happy love life. At a bohemian party, Nicholas leads Jane up to a bedroom where they sit on the edge of an unmade bed, and he says to her, "Tell me about Celina." Then, "Tell me about the borrowing and lending of clothes." Jane wants a man, but she has only her father's old made-over dark suit to wear. And Jane does not understand, too, that literary men, if they like women at all, do not want literary women but girls, says Spark. Yet Celina steals the dress, in any case, not to win Nicholas or any man, but because it is the most beautiful thing and she is the most beautiful girl. In a modernist culture where, as Patricia Waugh notes, the aesthetic so often stands in for the ethical, the fetishization of items of clothing confers on them a kind of tantric or sacramental power. This is why Nicholas is so shocked by Celina's rescuing of the Schiaparelli rather than Joanna at the climax. He had been, as Spark succinctly recounts, enamored of the May of Tech Club as an aesthetic and ethical conception, lovely frozen image that it was. He has imposed a once-upon-a-time narrative upon reality, in which the aesthetic certifies the ethical, and assumed that Celina joined the two entities in her beautiful person. but he errs primarily not because he believes Celina is more virtuous than she is, but because he sees her and her housemates as lovely frozen objects rather than humans with complex desires. Again, what do women want? Both Celina and Jean Brody refuse to play games in which female style is only a code for male desires. Not that these spinsters and single girls necessarily view the world purely in terms of traditional female desires. As Updike noted, Eros is secondary for most of Spark's women, and this circumstance regularly puzzles her male characters. In particular, the stylish spinster is disturbing because she seems, like Spark in writing her novels, to choose style over any realized substance, especially as we see with Miss Brody, the substance of marriage. Jane, like Sandy Stranger, bears a commonality with Spark herself in privileging personal ambitions, but at the price of being frequently interpreted as bisexual or simply desexed. Only Jane is left a spinster at the book's end, and yet she is no pathetic single woman, but a tough observing consciousness, like the author herself. Still, Nicholas the Catholic martyr has the last word. He marvels at her stamina, and he remembers it years later in the country of his death. Miss Jean Brody stages, aestheticizes, and can't fully objectify herself. The girls of slender means enact the risks and limits of romanticizing or self-aestheticizing. Only in the driver's seat can we see the ultimate stylish spinster, whose self-aestheticizing ends in her death. Excuse me. By 1970, when this novel was published, the very concept of spinsterhood was retro, of course. High fashion itself was considered old-fashioned and classist. The wild colors and inelegant shapes of 60s styles could be encapsulated in Mary Quant's pronouncement, "Good taste is death, vulgarity is life." In the driver's seat, Lise dresses for, first, and plans for, her own death. Perhaps the ultimate version of a knowing dédoublement. The novel itself is slim and stylish. There is something akin to fashion in the smooth appearances of the fiction, and something akin to bright, shocking, plastic 60s style in Lise's experiences, as well as her outfits. Certainly Spark herself thought so. She gained publicity for The Driver's Seat through fashion magazine interviews, and she considered it her best novel. It's a dark satire on the old chauvinist stereotype of the woman who asks for it. But ironically, Lise does not ask for that. She does not want sex, she says to the men who pursue her. Don't rape me, she says to the hapless fellow she maneuvers into a dark garden. Just kill me. It is the climactic moment she has planned and dressed herself for, but it's not a triumph for Lise in the end. The narrative opens with Lise clothes shopping for her holiday, although we quickly see something odd about her errand. She has donned a garment with, wait for it, green and purple squares on a white background with blue spots within the green squares, cyclamen spots within the purple. I don't have a picture of that either. Lise terms the combination lovely colors, but the narrator seems to concur with the bored shop girl. It is too vivid, that's why it's on sale. But it is the shop girl's assurance that the material doesn't stain that opens a wide gulf between Lise and us. She reacts with outrage. She pulls the dress off hastily. She throws it on the floor. She accuses the shop girl of assuming she's a sloppy eater. In fact, she doesn't want that new stain-proof material for mysterious reasons of her own. She continues scanning shop windows for the necessary dress for her holiday. Eventually, she buys one with a lemon yellow top with a skirt patterned in bright V's of orange, mauve, and blue. And the cover of this recent Penguin is pretty approximate to that, but it's not really lemon yellow. This is not as bright as it should be. I think they couldn't endure to put that on the cover, nor could they endure to put on it the coat, the summer coat, patterned with narrow stripes, red and white, that she chooses and wears with it. Throughout the story, people stare at her clashing costume, but Lise maintains that the colors go together perfectly. People here in the North are ignorant of colors, she says. If only you knew, these colors are a natural blend for me, absolutely natural. If Jean Brodie's red poppy dress was just right for her coloring, Lisa's startling style is appropriate for her in another way. Bill, the macrobiotic disciple and least perceptive of the men she encounters on her trip, calls her clothing psychedelic. Anybody remember that term? I'm probably the oldest person here. It's a pop term, of course, for hallucinatory patterned colors, and one which was often applied to late 60s and early 70s styles. Lisa's clashing attention-getting colors are in fact a visual non sequitur. They are the imagistic equivalent of Jean Brodie's enchanting lessons, both the sign of her unbalanced inner self and the enactment of a coming collision. For why, by the way, would she want a dress that stains? Usually it's assumed that Lise wants the blood to show after she's killed. This too is a non sequitur, since she won't be around to appreciate the aftermath, unless she's able to objectify herself so extremely that she can enjoy the prospect of her murderer being hunted down and prosecuted in advance. Certainly the new stain-proof material offers an image of the polyester 60s. All the modern technologically created freedoms are scorned and by implication useless for Lisa's purposes. The world is ruled by artifice in this novel. Like her clean Scandinavian furniture, which signifies that the swaying tall pines have been subdued into obedient bulks. The natural is destroyed to make the natural look, including the garish colors that Lise insists are absolutely natural for her. But there's nothing more natural than blood, and nothing harder to subdue into art, or indeed, to bottle up again. Here we have a picture of the film, 1974, The Driver's Seat, which was called Identikit in the European release. Mona Washburn, Elizabeth Taylor, totally miscast from my point of view. I mean, Elizabeth Taylor is herself too vivid. She can almost carry off those colors, and they don't quite have her clashing as much as Lisa's outfit is. And of course, Elizabeth Taylor is still very pretty and so not a spinster. Lise is a stereotypical spinster. Lise is alone. She's a bit odd. She's neither pretty nor plain. Moreover, she's in search of a man, just like that stereotypical feared spinster. "I'm looking for my type," she repeatedly says, in a nastily funny parody of romance. A solo holiday trip to an exotic destination, in this case an unknown southern European city, might indeed conclude in romantic union. Yet from the moment she steps on the airplane, Lise quests for her ideal murderer. The narrative is impelled by the question, who's the lucky guy? Lise believes in preordained meetings, she says. She tells Mrs. Fiegke, this is Mrs. Fiegke, her newfound elderly friend, that she expects to meet her boyfriend. "He knows I've come all this way to see him. He knows it all right." Mrs. Fiegke, the kind, slightly vague old lady, and Lise shop together. Lise buys scarves and neckties, which she will provide to her murderer to tie her up with. They discuss the extremes of hippie and youth culture disdainfully, and Mrs. Fiegke sympathizes with Lisa's complaints about men. "Too much self-control, which arises from fear and timidity," Lise comments. "They're cowards, most of them." To which the old lady responds with a remarkable misanthropic monologue, turning on 60s style. "They, men that is, are demanding equal rights with us," she says, "perfume, jewelry, hair down to their shoulders. There was a time when they would stand up and open the door for you, they would take their hat off, but they want their equality today. All I say is that if God had intended them to be as good as us, he wouldn't have made them different from us to the naked eye. They don't want to be all dressed alike anymore." Mrs. Fiegke cannily notes a major shift in the 60s, young men abjuring the traditional dark business suit and competing with women in floral designs and bright colors and so forth. "Fur coats and flowered poplin shirts on their backs," she says. "If we don't look lively, they will be taking over the homes and children and sitting about having chats while we go and fight to defend them and work to keep them." Her upside-down rhetoric is broadly funny. It's almost a Dickensian speech and very unusual for Spark. But their speech also underlines for us Lise's upside down perspective. Lise wants to sit in the driver's seat to rule her own life and death. And she does twice take the wheel and basically hijack a man's car in the story. After fending off various advances, sexual advances, from men who aren't her type, the young man she fixes on and lures into the park is as traditional as Mrs. Fiegki could wish. In fact, he is Mrs. Fiegki's nephew, and he wears a dark business suit. But Lisa's careful plans slip at the end. Like Jean Brodie, Lisa's shown only from without. Even the narrator remarks, "Who knows her thoughts? Who can tell?" She makes herself into a psychedelic art object, seemingly with perfect success. But she slips from object to subject at the end, when her young chosen murderer, that we can hardly help saying she preys upon, rapes her. In this upside-down world, Lisa's insistence on her autonomy, on inventing and starring in her own story, has been so chillingly convincing that even though we're persistently troubled by knowledge that she is literally a victim, we still feel a strange sympathy for this guy. And at the end, in fact, she doesn't get her own way, which is why Jared Carruthers has termed Lisa's rape and killing the darkest moment in all Sparks fiction. Even the girl who asks for it, who wants the most derogating, abject treatment offered by the other sex, cannot get what she wants, it seems. The novel concludes with the words, "Fear and pity, pity and fear," the proper response to tragedy, propelled, as we know, by a flawed central figure, but also the proper response to a deadly self-aestheticization, reminding us that no woman, no one, is purely an object until she is dead. Murder is the ultimate act of objectification. What did Lise want? Did she receive her desires? Who can tell? Why does Spark show an increasing grimness in these fictions? What's she saying about the project of self-aestheticization? It is a dangerous modern undertaking and a deadly postmodern one, because postmodernism is unmoored from custom. In Miss Jean Brodie, Sandy served as successful objectifier and moral center, albeit in an easy one, in retreat from the world. The girls of slender means also have their outside observer, Nicholas the Martyr, who, like Sandy, is fascinated by the self-styler, but also impelled by her amorality to retreat from the world of male-female relations. In the driver's seat, there's no one to be converted to religious faith, no one to retreat even, no one to serve as moral center, only the blank creation of tragedy. Spinsters, nuns, monks, like classic style, have become obsolete. We are left with a murderee in a world without rational erotic relations. Well, finally, what about Spark herself? She learned to self-aestheticize, rather surprisingly, around the time that she shut herself off from marriage in the non-elegant postmodern era of Lisa's psychedelic dress. Like Miss Brodie, Spark was past her prime in a time that worshipped youth. "That is no country for old men," wrote W.B. Yeats. "The young in one another's arms caught in sensual music." That's from Sailing to Byzantium. Yeats's modernist poem is all about making oneself into art in lieu of authentic human relations. It also, of course, is about aging. So in the 60s, Spark herself, ignoring the new trends, redressed herself as a couture-wearing figure of glamour. Her biographer, Martin Stannard, tells how, after a 1959 interview where she was described as 40-ish, plump, motherly, and buff-suited, the author reinvented herself as stylish and slender. From then on, her public persona was dressed to kill. This is almost not fair because she's very young in this picture, but plump and motherly in the early 1940s, and here she is in 1970 in a posed photograph in Rome. And there are many more, especially taken by photographer Jerry Bauer, like this. Certainly, various old friends and acquaintances testify to this. They recall meeting and failing to recognize her after her transformation. In 1971, the ever-tactless Philip Toynbee went to Rome to interview her and commented that Spark was very different from the dumpy bohemian girl he used to know. And I believe he said this to her face in the interview. The many photographs of Spark in her 50s and 60s show a woman who appears unbelievably younger than her age, also younger than her early 40-ish self. As a reborn spinster, she styled herself freely, presenting herself as her own work of art, but cannily, only for the public, to her life's end. Here's a couple more pictures of her, quite elderly, but still obviously very, very concerned with style. Simultaneously, her books grew more stylish and bland because the substance, as she saw it, had gone out of society. Yet she also seems to have been aware of the personal cost of the project. Now that she's gathered into the artifice of eternity, Yeats again, we can call Spark herself the most successful of her stylish spinsters. One does not feel that she ever stopped spying on herself. Thank you.